Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. We've all been there, wanting to exercise more, eat healthier, scroll less, be more present, but struggling to make it happen in any kind of meaningful, lasting way. We procrastinate. We forget. We make excuses. We quit. But there are ways to create significant change in our lives and the lives of others if we know how to go about it. Our guest is Wharton Professor Katie Milkman, author of How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. She's also the lead author of a study recently published in the journal Nature about what really motivates people to exercise. The results might surprise you, and we'll get to them in a moment. But first, we welcome Katie Milkman to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Tracy.
Well, thank you for being with us. Let me invite our audience to join in the conversation. Anyone who is contemplating the changes perhaps they want to make in the new year or just changes in general, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can give us a call at 888-477-9499. That said, Katie Milkman, why is it so hard for us to change?
It's a great question. It's hard for many reasons. One is, of course, the world isn't always on our side, and there's lots of barriers to change that are external to our lives. But actually, even if everything were working for us outside of our own mind, there's lots of internal barriers to change. You mentioned some of them as you were introducing me, ranging from the fact that we tend to be impulsive. We care more about the instant gratification we'll get from our decisions than the long-term benefits. So that's a major barrier in many cases to change. We're forgetful. We like to take the path of least resistance, which is a nice way of saying we can be a bit lazy. And sometimes we lack confidence even to make the changes we need to make. So there are so many of the ways that we think that unfortunately work against us when it comes to making a change that's quite difficult.
I want to explore several of those, but first I want to ask you this, because you were an engineering student. So what was it that got you interested in behavioral science and behavioral change in particular?
Well, I first got interested in behavioral science when I was required to take a microeconomics graduate sequence as a student of engineering. That might sound odd, but I was in a joint program in engineering and management. And I learned about this burgeoning field at the time. I'm dating myself, but it was the early 2000s. And I learned about this new field of behavioral economics that listeners might have heard of if they've read books like Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Nobel laureate Danny Kahneman. It's a field that systematically documents ways in which people are imperfect and attempts to model them. And I was really fascinated to learn that there's a whole science of understanding our foibles. And I got really interested in thinking about, really from an engineering perspective, how can we engineer solutions to those imperfections in the human mind? How can we help ourselves make better choices?
And I heard you say in your TED talk that there was a statistic that you came across in particular that just really came like a gut punch for you.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was an assistant professor at Wharton, I wandered over to the medical school and I attended a talk there that really changed my life, because it showed this graph. I'm such a nerd that a graph changed my life, but it was an amazing graph. It was a pie chart breaking down the proportion of premature deaths in this country that are due to different causes, things like accidents, environmental exposure, genetics, and so on. And what blew my mind is that the biggest wedge in that graph documented premature deaths due to decisions we could change. 40% of premature deaths are the result of choices we make on a daily basis about what we eat, what we drink, whether we smoke, whether or not we're safe when we get into vehicles, whether or not we're physically active. I just could not believe what a huge proportion of decisions were caused, premature deaths were caused by those kinds of decisions. And it focused my career on trying to help improve choices that people make about health, about their finances, about their savings, all areas where I realized the potential to have a really big positive social impact through science was large as a result of how much of our lives are guided by these small decisions.
Yeah, that's a staggering statistic. If I heard you right, you said 40% of premature deaths essentially are preventable.
That's exactly right. Well, probably more are preventable, right? Because accidents are preventable too, but 40% are really about daily decisions we make about simple health choices.
Yeah. Just last week, one of your studies on motivation was published in the journal Nature, and it involved motivating people to exercise and giving them a variety of incentives. And it was a very large study. Can you tell us about that, kind of who you studied, what were the incentives that you offered, and what did you take away from it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. This was a massive collaboration run by the Behavior Change for Good Initiative, which I co-direct with Angela Duckworth at the University of Pennsylvania. And the project was aiming to do something kind of different than we usually do in social science. We partnered with a national gym chain, 24 Hour Fitness, and we recruited over 60,000 of their members for a four-week program designed to help them build healthier habits around exercise. And what was different about this project than the way science is usually done when we study behavioral questions is that we didn't have just one hypothesis we wanted to test. We wanted to radically advance knowledge about behavior change. And to do that, we actually partnered with 30 scientists around the world and asked each of them to come up with their best design of a program that might help people be motivated to exercise more regularly. And then we tested 54 different programs in our study to see what worked best. And they had all different ideas in them. So some scientists were interested in trying to change mindset around exercise and fitness. Some were interested in trying to use incentives to motivate behavior change and try to prevent people from, say, falling off the wagon if they had a missed workout. Some were focused on social norms, meaning conveying what everyone else around you is doing. So that all of these different ideas were tested at once. And then we looked to see what happened over the course of a month, and that's the result that we published in Nature.
So what did you come up with? First of all, what were some of those incentives that you offered people?
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of people focus on the incentive portion of this. And what I think is important to mention is that we didn't really offer meaningful incentives to people. It was more of a sort of a points program just to be a little cherry on top if people went to the gym. So most of the programs didn't pay out more than 75 cents total to people over the course of a month. And most of the incentives were an order of magnitude. People are getting like 22 cents that they can turn in for an Amazon gift card. So this is, we call them micro incentives. It's a really small amount of money. It's more to draw attention to the fact that there is something rewarding beyond just the exercise itself so that you can, you know, use that to help motivate yourself to change your behavior. But we did a lot of different things across these different versions of the program. First of all, we're comparing all of the programs. This is a massive randomized controlled trial. We're comparing them all to what we call a placebo program, where if someone signs up and they're randomly assigned to get an empty shell of a program. They're welcome to the program. They're told they've won some points that are equivalent to what we expected other people to earn in the different versions just to hold gift exchange constant. And then they never hear from us again. So that's the empty shell. And we see how much better than that can we do in terms of motivating people to exercise more? How many more gym visits will people take if we layer in different ingredients to this four-week program? So we had one version of it that we called sort of best practice. Based on past research, what that basic version included was, first of all, people came in, they're prompted to make a plan. What are the dates and times when you intend to exercise over the next month? Then we text them reminders 30 minutes before each of those scheduled gym visits, just to say, you know, don't forget, this is when you plan to go to the gym. And finally, they can earn these points convertible for Amazon cash worth 22 cents each. So that's our basic program. And the first thing we found is just that program increased gym attendance by 9% over the course of the four-week program. So that's great. It's a statistically significant increase. And we're delighted that we can prove this very low-cost program has value. But what was a bit more exciting is what we found beat that. So we layered some additional ingredients on top of it. First of all, 45% of the programs that we designed significantly increased gym attendance, and all of them but one directionally increased it. So everything that scientists designed basically works better than nothing. That's essentially true. But about half of the things they designed are statistically significant, meaningfully better than nothing. And then what we found is a few things that were real standouts that outperformed this basic program. My favorite, and I think this is an insight listeners will particularly appreciate, was a program that tried to keep people from having a series of missed gym visits. So if you typically, you know, if you say you plan to work out on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, the way this program works is if you miss Tuesday, you get a little extra incentive, a few extra points if you come back on Thursday and don't have two misses in a row. In fact, 9 extra cents worth. So it's not a meaningful amount of money. It probably doesn't cover the gas to get to the gym, but it's enough to attract your attention and make you think, you know, okay, I really don't want to miss 2 planned visits in a row. Let's not fall off the wagon completely. That increased gym attendance by 27% over the course of the month. That really, really low cost incentive, and that was a top performer in our program.
So it sounds like it really didn't take much in the way of incentives. I mean, the amounts that you're talking about are not going to break the bank by any means. But what's the takeaway then for someone who's looking to maybe motivate themselves to get to the gym or help motivate a loved one to get to the gym? What can we take away from what you learned about ways to kind of stick with it?
Great question. I think these sort of basic ingredients of the programs that worked are things that people can largely create for themselves. So you can go and make a plan for what dates and times you intend to work out. You can put it on a calendar, make sure that you have a calendar app that pings you with push notifications, ideally a little bit before you're supposed to make those scheduled workouts. You can do that all for yourself. There are lots of apps out there with rewards programs that are sort of, you know, equivalent to these pennies that people are earning for making it to the gym. And so looking out for something like that might be a tool you could layer on top to motivate you. And then finally, if you could even ask a relative or a friend who cares about you to promise, you know, a few cents for every gym visit if you really want to do it that way. I think this top performer, which highlighted how important it is not to have a series of misses, while we implemented in a way where we're paying people a small amount for this, I suspect it could be effective to simply try to create that rule in your mind or focus on that for someone else you're trying to help and say, you know, what's the schedule? What's the plan? And if ever you fall off the wagon, just don't let it accumulate to more than one miss. That's something you can emphasize for yourself or for someone else. And that rule of getting right back on the wagon after a failure, I think it seems to be quite motivating. And so that's a useful insight for everyone, I think.
So I've got about 20 seconds before we take the break, but conventional wisdom says it takes 21 days to form a new habit. True or false?
False.
Really?
Very false. And we can talk more after the break about why.
All right. Well, there you have it. So we have much more to talk about with Katie Milkman. She is the author of How to Change, the Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. This is a time of year when a lot of us are thinking about how can we do things differently in the new year. And we've got more science and more ideas about how to motivate real change when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, we are talking about how to change. It's that time of year when a lot of people are thinking about that. And our guest is Katie Milkman, a Wharton professor and author of the recent book, How to Change, the Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. We all know that change is difficult, but there are some proven ways to help all of us change, to motivate ourselves and others to change, and ultimately to make it stick. We want to invite you to join the conversation as well. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can just give us a call at 888-477-9499. Katie Milkman, when we left off, I was asking you if the conventional wisdom is true that it takes 21 days to form a habit, and you said emphatically that is not true.
Yes, emphatically it is not true. My friend, Wendy Wood, who's a probably the world's expert on habit, a professor at University of Southern California, once explained to me where that came from. She tracked down that fact. It's not really a fact, that false fact, I should say, that piece of false information. And it's from a study that was done of how long it takes people who've had plastic surgery to get used to their new face. So it takes about 21 days before people feel comfortable with their new face. So that is not how long it takes to form a habit. But somehow it's everybody thinks that's true. Research that has been led by Colin Kammerer at Caltech that I got to be involved in used machine learning to try to understand how long it takes for people to form habits around two very different behaviors. One was gym attendance and one was hand sanitizing if you're a caregiver at a hospital and you're entering a patient's room. And what this work shows is, first of all, there's huge variation across people in how long it takes to form an automatic habit. Second, it really differs across these two contexts what the norm is. So with that very simple behavior of sanitizing your hands, it looks like it takes a couple of weeks to form a habit. It's something you repeat frequently. When it comes to gym attendance, the typical person takes more like several months to form a habit. So it really is domain specific. And it also, again, huge variation across people. There's no magic number.
So it takes as long as it takes is what it sounds like.
Well, you know, repetition creates habits. Rewards create them. And the more repetition, the better. And you can repeat something like hand sanitizing more frequently. It's a less complex activity. You can do it many times a day. So that gets you to probably the habit faster than something more complicated, like, you know, putting on your gym clothes, driving to the gym. You can probably not going to do that more than once a day. So that's going to take longer. And so it's going to depend on the complexity and the frequency at which you can engage in the behavior.
So I mentioned at the beginning of the show that toward the end of every year, of course, many of us start thinking about New Year's resolutions. You know, we decide that we're going to eat better, we're going to exercise more, we'll be more present, we'll scroll less, so on and so forth. But what is it about the turning of the calendar that tends to inspire us to want to change? And how much does timing matter when we're thinking about change?
I love that you asked that question because it's one of my favorite topics. I've done a bunch of research on what my collaborators and I call the fresh start effect. Heng-Chen Dai of UCLA, who's my former Wharton student, and Jason Reese of Wharton are collaborators on this work where we dig into why it is that there are moments in our lives like the start of a new year when we're extra motivated to pursue our goals. First of all, we show that New Year's is not an anomaly. There are lots of moments like this, moments that feel like new beginnings, like we're turning the chapter in and saying, you know, we have a fresh start because, you know, I've moved to a new community or I've moved to a new job or it's the start of a new week. That can be a mini chapter break, the start of a month or a season, the celebration of a birthday. These are all moments where, again, we have this sense that one chapter is closed in our lives, another is opened, we have a clean slate, and we feel more separated from our past selves. On January 1, you can look back at last year and say, you know, I meant to quit smoking last year, but that was the old me, and this is the new me, and the new me, it's going to be different, because you feel that separation from your past failures. It gives you renewed optimism.
So
it's common to feel these feelings, and they're really beneficial in terms of motivating change.
Are there any downsides to that, to the sort of the fresh start, you know, new me idea?
It's a great question. One thing that many people pick up on appropriately is that a huge number of New Year's resolutions fail. It depends on what study you look at, what estimate you prefer, but you know, the failure rate ranges from 20 to 50% to 80%. I've even seen in some studies of New Year's resolutions over a couple of years, right? So really wide variation in how high the failure rate is, but it's certainly many New Year's resolutions, probably most, fail. And so people get upset about that. They say, isn't this all a waste of time? To me, I think that misses a broader point, which is that we cannot achieve change unless we make an effort towards it, unless we start taking action, setting goals differently in an attempt to make the change. It doesn't just come about magically. And so I think it's great that there are moments that we use as social organizers to encourage each other to make positive change, to ask ourselves, what will we do differently? But again, the key is it's not always going to pan out. And what can you do? And there's a lot of science now that can help to give yourself a better shot at succeeding. And recognize also that change is hard and that most attempts probably won't be successful. So you'll probably need to try a second time, a third time, maybe a fourth time, and look for those additional fresh starts throughout the year that can give you the motivation to pick up and start again.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of what you wrote about disruptions, that, you know, even when you go with this sort of fresh start idea, that sometimes the right disruption can derail you if you're not careful, right? Once you sort of get on a path to better behavior, certain disruptions can maybe threaten that progress.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things about fresh starts, and actually this is dissertation work done by Heng Chen Dai of UCLA, who I mentioned earlier, she showed that while fresh starts are great for us in many circumstances, right, when we need a new beginning, when we need a clean slate to motivate a change, they can be disruptive if things are going well. And she has this fascinating study of baseball players, of all things, who are traded in the middle of a season, looking at how that trade changes the trajectory of their batting average. And what she finds is that all trades are not created equal. So that's kind of the interesting part of the paper, is that, first of all, some players get traded across leagues and some within leagues. And it turns out when you get traded across leagues, all your season-to-date statistics are reset and you start over. So it's kind of like a fresh start, a bigger fresh start with the move than if you're traded within league and you get to hold on to your records. Well, if you've been having a bad season, right, you're performing well below average, and you get traded across leagues and get this fresh start, that turns out to be great for you compared to someone who's traded within league and has to hold on to that baggage. You see this bump in performance. But if you were having a great season, then you really don't want to be traded across leagues and have that reset and that fresh start. It actually harms you relative to being traded within leagues, where you get to hold on to that strong performance record. So the message of this and lots of other studies she's done, but that one is a particular favorite, is really fresh starts are helpful when we want to create something new, we want to turn a page, but when things are going well, we actually have to look out for them and try to create continuity in whatever ways we can so that those disruptions won't throw us off our game.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of how to create change in whatever way. You write in the book that when it comes to making meaningful change, we need to start by sizing up our opponent. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, one of the things that has frustrated me most in my career, when I work with organizations, when I work with students, and teach them about the science of behavior change, is that there's this tendency to want sort of a one-size-fits-all solution to change, right? Like, there are lots of books like this that say, you know, just, you know, go set big audacious goals or visualize success. There's the one, this is the thing to do and you will get there prescription that's offered. But what I have found is that it really depends on what the barrier is to change, which scientific tools are going to be the most useful, right? If the reason someone isn't taking their medications regularly is that they're forgetting, then reminders are going to be incredibly powerful and useful for them. But if it's because there's some side effect that is unpleasant, reminders are not going to solve the problem. You need a different tool to solve a different kind of problem. So what I advocate for in my book and in my teaching at Wharton is the importance of trying to actually spend a little time diagnosing what is the barrier to change. Is it forgetting? Is it impulsivity? Is it that you can't find the motivation to start? Is it a lack of confidence? All of these barriers are very real. Sometimes they operate in conjunction. But once you understand what the barrier or barriers are, you can do a much better job of using scientifically proven tactics to tackle that problem or that constellation of problems, rather than just sort of throwing darts in the dark.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about change across all levels, especially as we are approaching a new year. Katie, I want to talk a little bit more about some of these barriers to change. And you just talked about how it's important to identify them, isolate them, and then kind of figure out a plan to work around them. Can you give us some concrete examples of what, you know, those barriers might look like and ways, you know, that have been scientifically proven that we can eliminate them or at least work around them?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest barriers that is the most common to encounter, especially when it comes to New Year's resolutions, is impulsivity, or economists call this present bias, the tendency we have to focus on the here and now and the rewards we'll get instantly for making a choice, and undervalue the long-term benefits of whatever course of action we could take. So think about, you know, eating pizza versus salad for lunch. It's going to be much tastier. Well, there's some really great salads out there, especially in Philly, but it's going to be much tastier on average for most people, more instantly gratifying to pick up that pizza slice instead of the salad. Exercise is another one of those things where it's going to feel better in the moment to sit on the couch probably than to get up and head out for a run, but the run is better for you in the long run. Saving for retirement, it's more fun to go spend your paycheck all in one go, but it's better for you in the long run if you save at least a portion of that for the future or for an emergency. So impulsivity tends to keep us from achieving a lot of our goals. Well, when you think about impulsivity, there's a bunch of research on what we can do to improve upon our outcomes. One of my favorite findings actually really flips the script on impulsivity. So this is research by Ayelet Fishbach of the University of Chicago and Caitlin Woolley of Cornell University. They show that most people, when they have a goal, they think that the best way to get all the way to that goal is by just looking for the most efficient path, right? So say you want to work out regularly, you go find, and you want to get in shape, that's your end goal. You'd go find like the maximally punishing a calorie burning machine. Maybe it's the Stairmaster, and you just go for that, grind it out. You think efficiency is key in forming your plan. But a small fraction of people make a different decision. A small fraction of people actually try to find the most fun way to pursue their goal, which might be less efficient. So maybe a Zumba class with a friend instead of that Stairmaster. But what's fascinating is the people who make that alternative choice, that they try to pursue the fun, persist much longer. And this has been shown correlationally and experimentally. If you instruct people to pursue goals in ways that they find enjoyable, you see that people keep at it. And that ultimately is what leads to success, right? Because they enjoy it in the moment. And so now the instant gratification component of the equation isn't working against them, but for them. And one way I've studied to actually make it more instantly gratifying to pursue your goals is through what I call temptation bundling, which is linking something that you find tempting with something that would otherwise feel like a chore, so that you'll start looking forward to doing the activity that used to feel like an uphill battle. So with exercise, you can think about, you know, only binge watching your favorite TV show, whether it's Succession or Emily in Paris or Downton Abbey, you know, pick whatever it is.
Ted Lasso.
You only get to watch it. Ted Lasso, exactly. Yes, only get to watch it at the gym. And now you start looking forward to workouts, and we've shown in randomized controlled trials that this can increase physical activity substantially. And you can temptation bundle in lots of other parts of your life as well. It's not just a tool for exercise. Anywhere where there's something you might find a chore, link something you enjoy, like favorite podcasts or this radio show, only while doing household chores, favorite bottle of wine, only open that particular bottle when cooking a fresh meal for your family, picking up a favorite treat from a favorite coffee house on the way to hit the books or catch up on you know, work reading. So there's all sorts of different ways you can do this. And that turns impulsivity into an asset instead of a barrier to change.
I want to take a moment here and read a couple of comments. The first one is from Richard, who is a family doctor, who says that, you know, thus far the conversation has been circling around the gym as a form of exercise. He says, there are other things like going for a walk that are equally as important. A gym membership is not the only way to work out, and often not the best way for everyone. And certainly we want to make the point that we don't want to exclusively talk about, you know, getting ourselves to go to the gym, though we've been discussing that. But we'll have lots more to talk about, including getting people vaccinated and other kinds of changes. But Katie, your thoughts about that, that it's not just about getting people to the gym.
Oh, my goodness. I could not agree more. The reason we studied in a lot of our research gym attendance is because it's an objective, measurable outcome variable, and scientists get pretty obsessed with those, right? We don't have to ask people to self-report. We can actually check the log of who's come. But all of the tools that we're talking about can be used to motivate exercise at home, in your neighborhood, going for a jog on the Schuylkill River Trail, you know, whatever your favorite form of physical activity is. you can use any of these ideas to promote that. We have just studied it in the context of gym attendance because, again, the scientists obsess about measurability.
Yeah. Question here from Harry, who says, I'm trying to make myself more available, but it's very difficult, especially since the pandemic. I haven't dated in over 6 years, and I'm looking to meet up with someone and have a relationship, but can't even start.
Hmm. Well, the getting started problem is a very real barrier, right? There's something you know you want to do, but you have to find the motivation to sit down, make a plan, figure out how you're going to actually take some action. And fresh starts can be a big help in motivating change. So New Year's might be a good time for this particular listener to sit down and make a plan, set a goal concretely, and think about how are you going to get there? It sounds like you might need to think about signing up for a dating app or ask friends to set them up on dates and maybe set a goal of how many dates to go on per month or maybe even per week. The more we can break it down and actually make numeric targets part of the way we create goals, and the less it's sort of a vague, you know, someday I would like to meet someone, I hope to go on more dates, and the more it's a I'm going to do one a week, the further we get. So that could be really useful for this particular listener.
For sure. Also, I want to take a moment and just invite our listeners to share your thoughts about this. Did you set a goal? Did you make it? Did you miss it? If you missed it, what barrier got in your way? Or maybe you'll want to share what changes you're looking to make in the new year. But either way, we'd love to hear from you. Again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or of course, you can always just pick up the phone and give us a call at 888-477-9499. Katie, I only have about 30 seconds before we go to the break here, but I want to talk to you when we come back from the break about not just motivating individuals, but motivating groups of people, because you've done work around encouraging people to get vaccinated. How do you get people to go to the polls during an election? In other words, how do you change group behavior as opposed to individual behavior? And we're seeing a lot of attempts at that right now. So think about that, and we want to talk about that when we come back after the break. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We welcome your comments and questions as we talk with Katie Milkman about how to change the science of getting from where you are to where you want to be. More on that when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about change, specifically how to do it, and we are talking with a change expert, Wharton Professor Katie Milkman, who wrote the book, How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. Katie, I said a moment ago that we want to talk about changing group behaviors as well. But before we get to this, just want to read a comment from Beverly, who says, my way of ensuring I exercise is I don't allow myself to sit down to watch TV. Unless I'm working in the kitchen, watching a news program, I only watch programs while I'm on my recumbent bicycle. It's a whole lot cheaper than gym membership, and I don't have to go anywhere. Daily on the bike. So there you have it.
That's great temptation bundling.
Yeah, temptation bundling. Exactly, exactly. So we want to talk about changing group behavior, and I know that you have been involved in working to motivate people to get COVID vaccinations. Tell us about the work that you've done and what you've learned about what it takes to motivate people to get the shots.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when COVID began back in March 2020, my team was actually already thinking about doing some research in the fall of that year to encourage flu vaccination. It was something that we felt we could help with by using insights from behavioral science, and we'd done some work in this area before. And when it became clear that vaccines would be sort of our way out of this mess, we decided to scale up our efforts and do something more ambitious where we'd test dozens of ideas for the best messaging we could use to encourage a similar kind of vaccination. to what would eventually be available for COVID. So we were testing on the flu vaccine. So we'd have insights ready that could be then turned on, sort of, here's how we should communicate about COVID-19 vaccinations to be maximally effective. And I should note, in case anyone listening is skeptical about whether or not the ideas we'd discover would be useful, there has been research done since showing that our sort of top performing messages from our studies did indeed prove useful in encouraging COVID-19 vaccination. So we teamed up with Walmart pharmacies and did one study with about 700,000 Americans getting messages encouraging flu vaccination. We also did a study locally with Penn Medicine and Geisinger Health involving more like 50,000 patients who were going in to see a doctor for a healthy visit and were going to be offered a flu shot to see what we could say to them in the days leading up to that via text message to encourage them to accept a flu vaccine when it was offered. And what's really interesting is even though we tested dozens of candidate messages across these two studies that were designed by scientists around the world with different backgrounds, different ideas, we sort of settled on or found almost the same thing in both contexts, which was that the best performing messages tend to convey a sense of ownership. So they were really simple clinical messages from our providers that said, a vaccine has been reserved for you, or a vaccine is waiting for you, that rose to the top of the bunch, outperforming things like telling you a joke about the vaccine to make it seem lighthearted, like, you know, have you heard about the one about the flu? Don't spread it around, or conveying that you should do this to protect your community and friends, or that you could dedicate your shot to a loved one, just like you dedicate a marathon run, or everybody else is doing it, so you should too. But the best performers were these ownership messages, which may have been effective, we think, and based on some follow-up work, because they communicated to people, one, this is going to be recommended, right? It's reserved for you. Why would I have done that if I didn't recommend it, or it's waiting for you? It's going to be hassle-free. It's there. And also maybe a sense of exclusivity, right? Oh, this is yours and it's reserved, and especially you don't want someone else to get that. It's mine. So that was one of our sort of key findings. And as I mentioned, it was from studies done to encourage flu vaccine take-up, but then a recent paper published in Nature actually demonstrated that this very same ownership language could be used effectively to increase vaccinations against COVID. You know, so that's a big insight.
Yeah, and it's curious to me, Katie, that since the Omicron variant has reared its ugly head, we're hearing that vaccinations now are increasing. And I wonder why now? I mean, Delta was scary, and we didn't see exactly the same kind of surge that we're seeing now. Is there any way to account for why this particular variant now seems to have encouraged people to get out and get vaccinated?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's a lot of different things that likely contribute. You know, one is that there has been recently a recommendation of boosters, and also data suggesting that you're sort of going to get this if one way or the other. And the question is, are you going to get it back when you're vaccinated or not? And I think that the data showing how many people are getting it, how quickly around the world, is scaring some people who weren't already scared. People who had previous infections, but not vaccines, it seems, are not very well protected against this new variant. And so maybe that evidence matters. And of course, more and more employers and communities, including Philadelphia, are rolling out stricter mandates of various kinds. Right now, you can't dine in a restaurant in Philadelphia starting in January unless you're vaccinated. And, you know, those kinds of mandates, there's no question the evidence shows they work really well to motivate behavior change, because it's a huge cost to someone if they can no longer engage in these kinds of activities that add value for them. And so I think those things combined, plus kids can now get vaccinated. I have a 5-year-old, and we rushed as soon as it was available to get him a vaccine. But that may also be pooled with, you know, okay, maybe parents are thinking, if I didn't get it, but now my kid can get it, we could get it together. So all that's happening at once, and I assume that some combination is leading to the rush.
I want to go back to what you said a minute ago about the importance of messaging as it related to encouraging people to get vaccinated, and that there were specific and more sort of personalized text messages that seemed to be more effective. What about getting to people to the polls? Because that is another area where there are many, many efforts to get people to come out, especially, you know, in off-year elections or that sort of thing. But any election cycle, there seems to be a big challenge to get people to come out. And there's also the counter challenge where in some parts of the country, there are efforts to make it more difficult to vote. And so, you know, what do we know about that, and what encourages people to do something like that where there may or may not be a payoff for them in it?
Well, one of my favorite findings about voting is that you can really change voter turnout with some simple techniques that acknowledge that a barrier to follow through is simply flake out. People mean to do it, but a lot of people don't put it on their calendar. They mean to get around to it. They forget at the last minute. It doesn't sort of rise to memory. And so there's some great research showing that if you prompt people to make a concrete plan by asking them, you know, when will you vote? How will you get there? Where will you vote? So that they've thought through those details can substantially increase voter turnout. It's essentially an inoculation against forgetting. And it works because now you've embedded the plan more firmly in memory. People have thought through potential obstacles, and they've made a commitment. Even if it's just somebody on the phone who they'll never talk to again, it might still feel hypocritical to say, I'm going to vote on Tuesday at 9 a.m. at the church down the street from my house, and I'm going to walk, and then not actually follow through. So the research on this is maybe 10 years old, and now actually most parties include these kinds of planning prompts in their voter turnout scripts because they've proven so useful.
I want to take a few minutes here to look at some audience questions and comments. Pamela asks, how do I stop getting angry at my kids, or at least stop myself from saying things I don't want to as a result of that anger? I'm sure that many a parent can relate to that question.
Yes, including me. one thing that I think can be useful in that particular context is actually a bit of planning. So we just talked about the importance of making sort of if-then plans, are called implementation intentions. And if you can think through how you're going to handle a situation before it arises, so you're prepared and you're not completely acting on instinct, but you can sort of go to a script, that can be a useful way to, you're not going to forget that you have an alternative. So what might be a way to handle a situation that makes you angry with your kid, other than yelling, right? What's another thing you could do? It might be walking away, slamming the door, going into a room by yourself so that you don't say something you later regret. If you have a plan, it's easier to enact it in the moment of passion, if you will, rather than just feeling the frustration and letting it burst. So that would be one piece of advice, is just try to think that through in advance so that you can go to a plan instead of not having a fallback option.
Mm, good advice. I want to take a moment here to just clarify. We were talking about vaccines just a moment ago and about the variants popping up and people getting vaccinated. And we just want to clarify that in the United States, that the Delta variant is still, in fact, the biggest cause of hospitalization. In fact, we'll be talking more about that next week on Radio Times, but we do want to make sure, even as we talk about Omicron and the fact that we're still learning about it, that Delta, in fact, is the one that we are most concerned about and the one that is still the biggest cause of hospitalization at this moment. Question from Tim, who says, when does setting goals go too far? For example, I know someone who has a vision board and was so obsessed with her goal of buying the house on her vision board, she sold her own home to get it. Sometimes people can go to extremes.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point about goals. And there's research about how goals can, just like any sort of incentive or any source of motivation, have perverse effects, right? You're so obsessed with one goal that everything else falls away and you make bad decisions. That's absolutely possible because they're a focusing force. So they can be helpful. They can also be harmful. I think, you know, a key is to think about setting goals in the context of your life more broadly, and whether or not the people around you also think that the goals you're setting make sense, and have check-ins to make sure they don't think you're going too far. Sometimes other people, social supporters, can be really valuable, not only in cheering us on, but also letting us know when we're taking things beyond the point where they make sense. Yeah.
We have a tweet here from Kate who says, last New Year, I created a big spreadsheet with numeric goals. How many new albums to listen to, how many friend hangouts, hikes, films, books, recipes. I'm slightly short on some, but exceeded a bunch, and it's given me a push and a sense of accomplishment that I haven't had before.
That is wonderful. That makes me really happy to hear. And it makes sense, because in general, one of the reasons setting concrete goals is beneficial in the long run can be that the achievement of those goals gives you a what's called greater self-efficacy, a greater sense that you have the capacity to achieve. And it can be this, you know, virtuous cycle where you see that something good happens and it builds your confidence and you're more capable of pursuing the next goal. So that's a really wonderful story. And I hope lots of people will try setting some targets for themselves so they can feel the same virtuous cycle in 2022.
And there's a good sense of balance in there, right? Like, you set lots of goals and you fall short on some, you exceed some, but you take the encouragement from the ones that you exceeded rather than getting fixated on the ones that maybe where you fell a little bit short. And that, I think, can be a trap for some people.
Yeah, I think there is another trap that's worth flagging in the context of talking about multiple goals. Is there is research showing that if you make plans for more than one goal, if you really dive in and get detail oriented on figuring out how am I going to achieve several things at once, it can be demotivating because it feels overwhelming. So there is some evidence that, okay, it's fine to set multiple goals, but you might want to have a top priority goal that where you make the detailed plan, at least for, you know, month one, and then maybe you move on to the next, as opposed to sort of spreading yourself too thin when it comes to trying to achieve different things.
Good point. Katie, what is the biggest challenge that you've ever had with change, or the biggest change that you've had to make?
Oh, gosh. I think for me, one of the biggest challenges I faced with change came when I was transitioning to be a graduate student. And I had been a college athlete, and, you know, physical activity was really key to my mental health and productivity. But when I was sort of struggling as an engineering student with the brunt of the workload that I was facing, it was hard for me to squeeze in the time and make it a priority to be physically active. It's one of the reasons that physical activity has been a theme in a bunch of my research, is that it was so important to my health and well-being, and that I struggled with it. But I used temptation bundling to make it work. So I decided I'm going to link exercise with something that's a true source of entertainment and joy that will be a stress release. And so I'll look forward to it every day and crave those trips. And it completely transformed my mental and physical health to come up with that strategy. It worked so well for me and improved my academic outcomes too.
So for those who are listening, who are, you know, thinking ahead to the new year, or just thinking, you know what I'm doing is not working, it's time to make a change in whatever area of life that might be, bottom line it for us. In other words, package it up and put a bow on it. What are the things that in this last minute that we have or so that people need to be thinking about as they contemplate the changes they want to make in their own lives, or how to help someone else make meaningful change?
Yeah, I think really important to try to make it fun. Almost all the change we want to make, not all of it, but almost all of it, comes down at some level to this trade-off between what's instantly gratifying and what's good for us in the long run. And if you can just change that equation so that it's actually instantly gratifying to pursue your goals, for many people, that will be a huge win. I'd say leap on fresh starts. They can help motivate you to make a change. So use them. Recognize that they come about regularly. So if one doesn't work, you can use another. And then I guess a final thing we haven't talked about, but I just want to mention, is that it can be powerful to give advice and coach other people and to form support groups. When you advise others, you come up with insights that you can use yourself, and you build confidence. And when you get support from others, that is so important to building your confidence as well. And also, they can show you what's possible. So, bottom line.
A lot of good things to think about, especially as we come to the end of the year and we're all thinking about what we need to do differently, what are the changes, how can we be a better version of ourselves, and how can we help the people around us to do the same thing. Katie Milkman, it's been a delight talking with you. Thank you so much for your time and for your advice and wisdom for all of us on how to make real change.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tracy.
So the book is called How to Change, The Science of Getting from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler, and our engineer has been Al Banks.